This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In a few moments, President Obama is expected to nominate Elena Kagan as an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, currently Solicitor General of the United States, the first woman to serve in that position, previously the first woman to serve as Dean of Harvard Law School. If confirmed, she would be the fourth female justice overall, the third to serve on this court. At 50, she would also be the youngest justice and would replace the oldest, John Paul Stevens, who announced plans to retire last month. Elena Kagan has never been a judge. She was nominated to the federal bench near the end of President Clinton's last term, but never got a hearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee, then controlled by Republicans. Last year, she easily won confirmation as Solicitor General in a bipartisan vote. Because she's never been a judge, she does not have a paper trail of opinions and rulings, which worries some activists on both the right and left. But as of this morning, she's considered very likely to be a member of the court come the first Monday in October. With me here in the studio in Washington are Ron Elving, senior Washington editor, and Mara Liasson, national political correspondent. And Mara, Elena Kagan goes back with Barack Obama. They were both
both professors at the University of Chicago Law School. She obviously is his solicitor general. He knows her very well. She was also on the short list for his first pick, which went to Sonia Sotomayor. But I agree with everything you said. She's likely to be confirmed. What's interesting about her, because she has no paper trail as a judge, there are other things that are going to be poured over. And both the left and the right are complaining about her already. The left thinks she's too conservative. She's been in favor of a strong executive. The right is taking aim at something she did when she was the dean of Harvard Law School, and she banned the military recruiters, I think, for the JAG. I think that was – it wasn't yes. ROTC. It was the JAG, the Judge Advocate General, the legal arm of the military, from recruiting on campus because of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which, of course, was a policy that was supported by her previous boss, Bill Clinton, and her current boss, Barack Obama.
So she does say she is not a Unitarian, not speaking of her religion, of course, but about the idea of the unified presidency. But Ron Elving, as we look ahead to a confirmation process later this summer, hearings before the Judiciary Committee, the Obama administration would hope a vote before the August recess. She looks, if she got seven Republican votes last time around, she looks like she might be eminently confirmable.
She looks like she might be eminently confirmable, but I think we have to also consider what else happened this weekend, and that was that a senior senator, a three-term senator, Bob Bennett from Utah, was denied 40% at a convention of Utah Republicans, and as a result, will not even be allowed to participate in the primary in that state. He has been politically assassinated out there. He has been taken down by conservative populist activists associated with the Tea Party, and I think that there are going to be shockwaves. There were already a lot of anticipatory shockwaves going through the Republican Party just because Bob Bennett had been targeted and was in trouble. Now I think that there is going to be a feeling on the part of many Republicans that they must oppose absolutely everything Barack Obama does.
This event is in the East Room of the White House, and here is President Barack Obama, along with the Vice President Joe Biden and the nominee Elena Kagan.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Thank you. Thank you very much. Everybody, please have a seat. Good morning, everybody. Of the many responsibilities accorded to a president by our Constitution, few are more weighty or consequential than that of appointing a Supreme Court justice, particularly one to succeed a giant in the law like Justice John Paul Stevens. For nearly 35 years, Justice Stevens has stood as an impartial guardian of the law, faithfully applying the core values of our founding to the cases and controversies of our time. He's done so with restraint and respect for precedent, understanding that a judge's job is to interpret, not make law, but also with fidelity to the constitutional ideal of equal justice for all. He's brought to each case not just mastery of the letter of the law, but a keen understanding of its impact on people's lives. And he has emerged as a consistent voice of reason, helping his colleagues find common ground on some of the most controversial and contentious issues the court has ever faced. While we can't presume to replace Justice Stevens's wisdom or experience, I have selected a nominee who I believe embodies that same excellence, independence, integrity, and passion for the law, and who can ultimately provide that same kind of leadership on the court. Our Solicitor General and my friend, Elena Kagan. Elena is widely regarded as one of the nation's foremost legal minds. She's an acclaimed legal scholar with a rich understanding of constitutional law. She's a former White House aide with a lifelong commitment to public service and a firm grasp of the nexus and boundaries between our three branches of government. She's a trailblazing leader, the first woman to serve as dean of Harvard Law School, and one of the most successful and beloved deans in its history. And she is a superb Solicitor General, our nation's chief lawyer, representing the American people's interests before the Supreme Court. The first woman in that position as well. And she has won accolades from observers across the ideological spectrum for her well-reasoned arguments and commanding presence. But Elena is respected and admired not just for her intellect and record of achievement, but also for her temperament, her openness to a broad array of viewpoints, her habit, to borrow a phrase from Justice Stevens, of understanding before disagreeing, her fair-mindedness and skill as a consensus builder. These traits were particularly evident during her tenure as dean, at a time when many believed that Harvard faculty had gotten a little one-sided in its viewpoint. She sought to recruit prominent conservative scholars and spur a healthy debate on campus, and she encouraged students from all backgrounds to respectfully exchange ideas and seek common ground, because she believes, as I do, that exposure to a broad array of perspectives is the foundation not just for a sound legal education, but of a successful life in the law. And this appreciation for diverse views may also come in handy as a diehard Mets fan, serving alongside her new colleague, Yankees fan Justice Sotomayor, who I believe has ordered a pinstripe robe for the occasion. But while Elena had a brilliant career in academia, her passion for the law is anything but academic. She's often referred to Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall, for whom she clerked, as her hero. I understand that he reciprocated by calling her Shorty. Nonetheless, she credits him with reminding her that, as she put it, behind law there are stories. Stories of people's lives as shaped by the law, stories of people's lives as might be changed by the law. That understanding of law, not as an intellectual exercise or words on a page, but as it affects the lives of ordinary people, has animated every step of Elena's career, including her service as Solicitor General today. During her time in this office, she's repeatedly defended the rights of shareholders and ordinary citizens against unscrupulous corporations. Last year, in the Citizens United case, she defended bipartisan campaign finance reform against special interests seeking to spend unlimited money to influence our elections. Despite long odds of success, with most legal analysts believing the government was unlikely to prevail in this case, Elena still chose it as her very first case to argue before the court. I think that says a great deal, not just about Elena's tenacity, but about her commitment to serving the American people. I think it says a great deal about her commitment to protect our fundamental rights, because in a democracy, powerful interests must not be allowed to drown out the voices of ordinary citizens. And I think it says a great deal about the path that Elena has chosen. Someone as gifted as Elena could easily have settled into a comfortable life in a corporate law practice. Instead, she chose a life of service, service to her students, service to her country, service to the law, and to all those whose lives it shapes. And given Elena's upbringing, it's a choice that probably came naturally. Elena's the granddaughter of immigrants whose mother was for 20 years a beloved public school teacher, as are her two brothers who are here today. Her father was a housing lawyer devoted to the rights of tenants. Both were the first in their families to attend college. And from an early age, they instilled in Elena not just the value of a good education, but the importance of using it to serve others. As she recalled during her Solicitor General confirmation hearings, both my parents wanted me to succeed in my chosen profession. But more than that, both drilled into me the importance of service, character, and integrity. Elena's also spoken movingly about how her mother had grown up at a time when women had few opportunities to pursue their ambitions and took great joy in watching her daughter do so. Neither she nor Elena's father lived to see this day, but I think her mother would relish this moment. I think she would relish, as I do, the prospect of three women taking their seat on the nation's highest court for the first time in history. A court that would be more inclusive, more representative, more reflective of us as people than ever before. And I think they would be tremendously proud of their daughter, a great lawyer, a great teacher, and a devoted public servant who I am confident will make an outstanding Supreme Court justice. So I hope that the Senate will act in a bipartisan fashion, as they did in confirming Elena to be our Solicitor General last year, and that they will do so as swiftly as possible so she can get busy and take her seat in time to fully participate in the work of the court this fall. With that, I would like to invite the person who I believe will be the next Supreme Court Justice of the United States, Elena Kagan, to say a few words.
Thank you, Mr. President. I am honored and I am humbled by this nomination and by the confidence you have shown in me. During the last year, as I have served as Solicitor General, my longstanding appreciation for the Supreme Court's role in our constitutional democracy has become ever deeper and richer. The Court is an extraordinary institution. In the work it does and in the work it can do for the American people by advancing the tenets of our Constitution, by upholding the rule of law, and by enabling all Americans, regardless of their background or their beliefs, to get a fair hearing and an equal chance at justice. And within that extraordinary institution, Justice Stevens has played a particularly distinguished and exemplary role. It is therefore a special honor to be nominated to fill his seat. I have felt blessed to represent the United States before the Supreme Court, to walk into the highest court in this country when it is deciding its most important cases, cases that have an impact on so many people's lives, and to represent the United States there is the most thrilling and the most humbling task a lawyer can perform. I've been fortunate to have been supported in all the work I've done as Solicitor General by a remarkable group of lawyers and staff, many of whom are here today. They exemplify professionalism, public service, and integrity, and I am grateful for all that they have taught me. My professional life has been marked by great good fortune. I clerked for a judge, Abner Mikva, who represents the best in public service, and for a justice, Thurgood Marshall, who did more to promote justice over the course of his legal career than did any lawyer in his lifetime. I have had the opportunity to serve under two remarkable presidents who have devoted themselves to lifting the lives of others and who have inspired a great many more to do the same. I had the privilege of leading one of the world's great law schools and of working there to bring people together and to help ensure that they and the school were making the largest possible contribution to the public good, both in this country and around the world. I am proud of what all of us accomplished there. And through most of my professional life, I've had the simple joy of teaching, of trying to communicate to students why I so love the law, not just because it's challenging and endlessly interesting, although it certainly is that, but because law matters, because it keeps us safe, because it protects our most fundamental rights and freedoms, and because it is the foundation of our democracy. I am thankful to my brothers and other family and friends for coming to Washington to be with me here today. And much more, I am thankful for all of their support and loyalty and love, not just on this day, but always. If this day has just a touch of sadness in it for me, it is because my parents aren't here to share it. They were both, as the president said, the children of immigrants and the first in their families to go to college. My father was the kind of lawyer who used his skills and training to represent everyday people and to improve a community. My mother was a proud public school teacher, as are my two brothers, the kind of teachers whom students remember for the rest of their lives. My parents' lives and their memory remind me every day of the impact public service can have. And I pray every day that I live up to the example they set. Mr. President, I look forward to working with the Senate in the next stage of this process, and I thank you again, Mr. President, for this honor of a lifetime. Thank you so much.
Elena Kagan, just nominated by President Obama to be an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, speaking in the East Room of the White House, shaking hands with the President and Vice President Biden immediately afterwards. The applause, as she mentioned, largely from members of her staff at the Justice Department who were crowded into the East Room to mark this occasion. And Elena Kagan accepting on behalf of, all of those people she worked with. She spoke movingly about her family, about their traditions, about the career that she's had, first as she mentioned, a clerk for Abner Mikva, a just judge in Washington, D.C., then later for Thurgood Marshall, an associate justice of the Supreme Court. Then later, she served as a law professor at the University of Chicago and later at Harvard. She also served both the Clinton and Obama administrations. Currently, she is Solicitor General of the United States. You're listening to special coverage coming to you from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Studio 3A in Washington. With me, Ron Elving, Senior Washington Editor, and Mara Liasson, National Political Correspondent. And Mara, as we listen to this, you could expect the President to have kind words to say about Justice Stevens, who is retiring and certainly established a long record on his stay on the Supreme Court. And then, of course, nothing but compliments for his nominee.
You know, the president's advisors have said in advance of this decision that he wanted someone who could not just be a fair-minded justice, but somebody who had skills at building consensus in the hopes that they could actually put together some majority coalitions, some five-vote coalitions. And he said that again. He said, you know, she's fair-minded, but she also has skills as a consensus builder. And he pointed as evidence to the fact that she recruited prominent conservative scholars to come and teach at Harvard. Now, That's true, but I guess I consider this the theory, the great unproved theory of this nomination. We don't know if Elena Kagan is going to be able to actually convince Anthony Kennedy to join her on anything. And that's certainly what President Obama hopes. But we have no evidence that she'll be able to do that. And I actually don't think anybody who thinks she can should get their hopes up. But she is young, and I think that's one of the most important characteristics of her, qualifications of her nomination, is that she will be on the court for a very long time.
And Ron Elving, perhaps not a consensus builder immediately, but as Mara's suggesting, maybe down the road, she could take that role that John Paul Stevens certainly took on the court of molding people's opinions into groupings, perhaps not immediately, as rookie justices do not always have that much influence.
That is true. At the same time, we, of course, have this president who is a constitutional law scholar. He taught it at the University of Chicago. This was, in a sense, his profession before he got into politics. He cares a great deal about the long-term future of the Supreme Court. And let's posit just for the moment that his goal here is to, if he gets three or four nominees in the course of his presidency, His goal here is to construct the core of a new Supreme Court. And I think his ideal here would be a Supreme Court that was not nine liberals, that was not composed of people who all were driven by ideology, but who were excellent constitutional minds, excellent legal minds, who would work with each other to develop each other's ideas and to actually mature each other's ideas, moderate each other's ideas, and be a wise Supreme Court. Now, of course, he would believe that such a court would also probably comport
with
his own views.
99% of the time.
Exactly. Yeah. I wouldn't doubt that for a moment. But I don't think he idealizes this as a collection of liberals. I think he sees it as a collection of legal minds, and he sees Elena Kagan as being a perfect exemplar of that kind of legal mind.
She is, by any measure possible, a Democrat. She supported President Obama in the primaries. She worked for the campaign of the former governor of Massachusetts when he ran for president of the United States.
Good old Michael Dukakis.
Good old Michael Dukakis in 1988. Mara Liasson, though some liberal activists will say this is a lost opportunity. She is not noted as a liberal. This is the last time President Obama is likely to have 59 Democrats on the in the United States Senate, and that this was his great chance to appoint somebody who would take up the mantle of John Paul Stevens.
The other theory was that since you're never going to have more Democratic votes in the Senate than you do now, why not just go for it and go for the most liberal justice you can get? So they've been disappointed today. And the kinds of emails that we're all getting in our inboxes from liberal groups are quite lukewarm, saying, well, we look forward to listening to her throughout the hearings. I think that all of that reaction from the left is a great thing for the White House politically. I think they welcome it. This is a White House that often has worn as a badge of honor criticism from the left, kind of helps position them where they want to be in the center. I think in the end, you're not going to get Democratic liberals in the Senate voting against her. But what is going to be interesting, all these nominating processes are a battle for defining who the person is. And the nominee himself or herself tries to say as little as possible to define himself or herself in any direction. But there's going to be a big push from the right to define her as a liberal, as somebody who advocated strongly for gay rights when she tried to bar the military recruiters at Harvard. But it's interesting, she herself has, among the very few opinions that she has ever issued, expressed, she said that the nominating process was vapid. And she said it was terrible because nominees don't say anything and senators just posture. I am sure she will be very politely offered a chance to break from that stultifying tradition and say something more forthcoming and revealing about herself, and I am sure she will politely decline.
And on her behalf, President Obama has already spoken on the controversial Mets-Yankees issue. But nevertheless, Ron Elving, reaching out to conservatives as dean of the Harvard Law School, maybe not consensus building on the Supreme Court in the foreseeable future, in the next couple of years, but should be of benefit when it comes to a vote before the United States Senate.
It should be. It should be the kind of thing that can be worn as a badge of honor, and she should have some friends, in fact, among the Republican senators who respect what she did as the law school dean at Harvard. This was one of the bases on which she has established friendships of a kind, a professional kind, with some of the conservative members of the Supreme Court. Antonin Scalia, for example, John Roberts, Samuel Alito. These are people who she knows. These are people she has matched wits with, both as Solicitor General and in some of her other capacities. And so she is a known quantity to these people, and they respect what she did at Harvard. A lot of these people went to Harvard or have taught at Harvard. They have a kind of relationship with that faculty, which is a, you know, a powerhouse faculty and a if you will, a storehouse of legal wisdom and acuity for the entire legal community. So this was a big job. It was a kind of a precursor job to the responsibilities that she has had since, and she passed that test with flying colors from the standpoint of conservatives. That should give her a reservoir of goodwill, as it has, in fact, on the Supreme Court itself, and it should help her get a relatively smooth nominating hearing and nominating vote in the Senate. But, again, I have to say, as we did at the top of the show, this is not a normal United States Senate. This is not a typical or historically normative United States Senate. There is a grip of fear right now on a lot of the Republican senators that they cannot afford to be seen as accommodating to this president or to the Democrats in the majority or to liberalism in any way, shape, or form, even to a small degree.
So it would be interesting to look at, for example, how Lindsey Graham, the senator Republican from South Carolina, might treat her. He's a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee and somebody who's been under pressure under some of those exact things, but has worked with Democrats in the past.
And she got 7 votes when she was nominated for Solicitor General. She got 7 votes from Republicans on the Judiciary Committee and on the floor of the Senate when she was confirmed. 31 Republicans voted against her, but 7 voted for her. It will be fascinating to see the reasons put forward by those 7, or some of those 7, if they then vote against her for the Supreme Court.
31 happened to be the number of Republicans who also opposed Sonia Sotomayor a year ago, and may be predictive. But going back to those conservative appointments, Mara Liasson, some of them include lawyers who worked for the most recent Bush administration on some very controversial issues. And indeed, this is another source of criticism from the left, that she hired people some would consider war criminals.
That's right. One of the biggest flashpoints between the left and this administration is on foreign policy, not so much foreign policy, but national security policy and, how you treat terrorist defendants and detainees. And I think that is going to be a big point of criticism from the left, but I really wonder who in the Senate is going to take up that banner. I mean, there has to be some senator to press that case if that's going to be part of the confirmation hearings, and I can't see who that would be.
Possibly Russ Feingold.
Maybe
is there
Russ
a possibility?
Feingold.
He's on the committee.
Yeah, he's on the committee as well. Yeah. Joining us now is Ari. No, we don't have Ari yet. We're hoping to get Ari Fleischer in just a moment, who's at the event earlier today at the White House, so he'll be joining us shortly. But in any case, going back to this question, Nina Totenberg, as our esteemed colleague, has pointed out, John Paul Stevens is the last of the justices to come from the western part of the United States, that this is now would be, if Elena Kagan is confirmed as a justice of the Supreme Court, very much a northeastern Supreme Court. Indeed, 4 of the 5 boroughs of the city of New York would be represented on the United States Supreme Court.
So the boroughs of New York are better represented than the regions of the country. No question about it. Now, this is not a brand new criticism of the Supreme Court. It certainly goes back through our history that it was way too eastern in its orientation. Although the famous leaders of the court have oftentimes come from either the West or the Midwest. Recently, Warren Burger, Earl Warren, both were from west of the Mississippi, and even John Roberts, now the Chief Justice, is originally from the Midwest, although he's so associated with the
Washington,
exclusive institutions of the Northeast now that it's hard to still feel Indiana in there. But this is part, if you will, of the elitism of the court that has emerged in recent years, where we have gotten people who have been not just judges, but federal judges, and at the highest levels of the federal appeals court system. That has become the farm team to which presidents of both parties have looked to stock the court. So we haven't seen the political base. We haven't seen governors and senators being nominated. They've all been judges. And in fact, if Kagan is confirmed, she will be the only person on the court that didn't come there from a bench.
Although her experience doesn't really offer much of a counterpoint to that. She comes from the same basic elite,
absolutely,
liberal kind of northeastern academic training ground. Sandra Day O'Connor also was another Westerner who was gone. But it is really interesting. The court is getting more and more homogeneous, partly because of the decisions of Barack Obama, the great diversity president, which is kind of ironic.
And himself, a Midwesterner who has been introduced to the country mostly through the elite institutions of the Northeast.
Well, joining us now is Ari Shapiro, NPR White House correspondent. Prior to that, I can disclose, Justice Department correspondent, so with some familiarity with this nominee in both of those capacities. Ari, nice to have you with us.
Hi, Neil. Good to be with you.
And you've seen some of her work as Solicitor General of the United States, and for those who don't know that position, this is the person who goes in and argues before the Supreme Court on behalf of the government. And how has she done in that capacity?
Well, one of the striking things about her as Solicitor General is that many people who occupied that role had lots of experience arguing before judges, maybe even before the Supreme Court. Elena Kagan had none. And so when she first appeared before the Supreme Court, people were very eager to see how she would do her first time out. And she looked really comfortable. She had a great rapport. You know, the justices can be very aggressive in their back and forth with a lawyer arguing in front of them. She was, you know, like a pro playing tennis with them. And so the sense is that she has a good rapport with the eight people who she'll be joining on the court if confirmed. And that might help, as some people have talked about, her efforts to bring consensus, bring liberals and conservatives together, perhaps sway Justice Anthony Kennedy, who's sometimes a swing voter, to join the liberal minority.
And as she continues in this role, you were there at the White House. Has there been any indication of how the White House plans? What did you glean from the way the president presented her today and from what others at the White House are presenting to her as to how this campaign, and there's no other way to describe this, but the campaign for confirmation will be conducted?
Well, the two themes that stood out to me in the president's comments were her understanding of how the law applies to real people, which is a theme that President Obama has hammered away ever since he began talking about Supreme Court nominations before he nominated Sonia Sotomayor. But then the other theme that he emphasized with Kagan was her ability to bridge differences, to bring conservatives and liberals together. He talked about how, as dean of Harvard Law School, she helped diversify the faculty. In fact, one member of that law school faculty, Jack Goldsmith, was there in the audience today. He was a senior official in the Bush Justice Department, and when Elena Kagan brought him on at Harvard, there were protests from liberal faculty members and students. She really stood up and defended him, and so he was there in the audience today as, I think, sort of an embodiment of the theme that President Obama was talking about in his comments.
There is another issue that came up in a blog, I believe, on CBS, and that was that if confirmed, this was the report on the blog, Elena Kagan would be the first openly gay member of the United States Supreme Court. The White House came out with a quick and complete denunciation of that.
Right. She's not married. Friends of mine who work with her at Harvard, who worked with her at Harvard, friends of mine who are gay and lesbian who are at Harvard, say if she's lesbian, they're not aware of it. They have no reason to believe that she is lesbian. I have no reason to believe that she is either.
And there's no reason to believe that should play a part in this conversation. Nevertheless, it is something that is going to be part of the undercurrent, particularly given her stance on Don't Ask, Don't Tell, one of the few issues on which she's taken an absolutely firm stance, saying she considered that policy an outrage.
That's right. She said she considered it an outrage in the context of a battle between law schools and the military over the law school's non-discrimination policies. Any law school that joins the National Association of Law Schools has to sign on to an agreement saying they will not allow recruiters on campus who discriminate on the basis of gender, race, religion, and sexual orientation. Well, they considered the military an employer recruiting on law school campuses, and because the military discriminates on the basis of sexual orientation, Dean Kagan at Harvard and others said, this is not compatible with our non-discrimination policy. We have to keep military recruiters off campus. She took a very strong stance on that and lost. And that is one of the things that Republicans will point to as a reason that some of them will vote against her.
Yet there was a law, the Solomon Amendment, which was passed by Congress saying you either accept military recruiters or you lose your federal funding. She opposed that amendment, lost before the Supreme Court. And of course, this came up in her hearing to be confirmed as Solicitor General.
That's right. And the key was that it was not federal funding just for the law school. It was for the entire university. And so hospitals, research centers, other university-affiliated institutions that receive millions of dollars in federal money could have been jeopardized by keeping military recruiters off campus. And as you say, she lost, and that fight has dogged her ever since.
As in her nomination, in her hearing to be Solicitor General, she said, as an advocate for the United States government, if she was required to argue on behalf of the Solomon Amendment, she would do so happily before the Supreme Court. So that definitely will come up again. Mara Liasson, as you're looking at this political landscape, the campaign to have her nominated, again, the administration, the president and the vice president will seek to present her in a certain light, their opponents in another. What are going to be the distinguishing characteristics, do you think?
Well, I think that obviously her opponents are going to try to present her as too far out of the mainstream and that she's too liberal and that she is anti-military. I'm already getting emails suggesting that. And you heard a little preview of how the White House plans to present her: open-minded, fair-minded, consensus builder, has a background that allows her to be empathetic with ordinary people. I'm thinking about this fight also in a bigger context. I mean, this is happening just a couple of months before a midterm election where the Democrats are facing the prospect of huge losses. And I don't think that short-term political gain it really is what presidents think about when they nominate a Supreme Court justice. But she will become fodder for the fight that's already brewing. I mean, conservative groups are going to use her nomination to get their troops energized. Usually it's only activists on the left and the right that care about these nominations. And also, this is the kind of thing, if it gets contentious, unlike Sonia Sotomayor, which was almost 100% positive political thing for the White House because she was the first Hispanic justice. I think this does have the potential, there's nothing the president could do about it, to kind of take energy away from the topic that he wants to talk about now, which is the economy and jobs and how the economy is getting better. So you've got this thing, you know, it's just by its nature a distraction.
Ari, is there something, because of her job as Solicitor General, that she might have to recuse herself from, take her out of, not participate in either the arguments or in the opinions of any issues that come up before the Supreme Court?
Yeah, I think it's safe to say that assuming she is confirmed by the beginning of next term, which there's no reason to believe she wouldn't be, that there will be things in the pipe coming up to the Supreme Court that she may have worked on as Solicitor General, and obviously she would have to recuse herself from those things. But that's not unusual. When Chief Justice John Roberts took the seat on the High Court, he was coming from the D.C. Circuit Appeals Court, and there were cases, including one very important case involving executive authority and Guantanamo detainees, that Chief Justice Roberts had to recuse himself from. So that's not terribly unusual.
And Ron Elving, as we look ahead again to this is a political year. All the members of the House of Representatives are running for re-election, a third of the members of the United States Senate. You pointed out earlier the situation regarding the Senator Bennett in Utah, and that he lost his chance to be even on the primary ballot because of the tenor of the times, if you will. And in that context, as we look ahead to a very contentious summer, where is this battle going to play out?
I think the battle will play out first, of course, in the Judiciary Committee and then on the floor of the Senate, where there exists the possibility, no one has mentioned it up to now, but I think we should recognize that the Republicans in the Senate have been routinely filibustering, or, if you will, threatening to filibuster, which results in we've already had well over 150 cloture votes in this Congress. Not that long ago, you would have single digits per year cloture votes. This is a filibuster-ridden Congress, and the Democrats, while they have an overwhelming majority, do not have 60 votes. They cannot cut off debate with their votes alone. So if the Republicans were to choose to filibuster this nomination, there would have to be at least one Republican defector to defeat that filibuster. Now, we don't necessarily know that there is a commitment to filibuster or even a strong interest in filibustering on the part of the Republicans, but they could. And if something should emerge, let me throw out the example in the Sotomayor case of the, quote, wise Latina, unquote, remark that she had made in a speech, and averring at the time that she would hope that a wise Latina would make a better decision than a perhaps other kind of person, of gender-wise, ethnicity-wise. If something like that emerges about Kagan and they decide to dig their heels in, filibuster is a possibility.
Well, thank you very much. Ron Elving, senior Washington editor. Our thanks as well to Mara Liasson, national political correspondent, and to White House correspondent Ari Shapiro. You're listening to special coverage from NPR News.